To another episode of my pointless podcast, What a Waste of Time. I'm here with my good friends Nick.
Hello.
And Callum.
Hello.
Who has finally got the knack of enthusiasm.
That is sincere.
For now.
And, well, you guys pitched the topic for this episode, so why don't you tell us all about it?
Do you want to take the lead, Callum, because you're the main New Statesman boy in the house?
Yeah, sure. So the New Statesman they have a bunch of podcasts, but their main one it's just called the New Statesman Podcast. It typically covers current affairs in its most from a lefty insider-leaning perspective, which makes sense because that's what the New Statesman is. And it's a very good podcast. Sometimes in the sort of last third, they will cover something in the cultural sphere, sometimes with people from the sort of back pages of the magazine where they typically cover culture doing it. Sometimes it's Helen Lewis, who is one of the two main presenters of the podcast, on the current affairs side. She will also do something in this last third. Helen Lewis normally does something about theatre because that seems to be her area. Mm. However, this time Helen Lewis decided to bring on an author from a book that I have forgotten the name of, or the name of the author. I was going to say,
has anyone actually checked what the name of the dude was?
But it's not really about the dude or the book.
No, I think the book is called The Wall, which is, I mean, very timely.
Yes.
And
it's about climate change. And it actually sounded quite cool.
Yeah, it
sounded like... books sound good. On the podcast.
Yeah, it sounded like it. Like, Google it, I don't know. He and... I'd say this is relevant, not just because of my ageist prejudices. He and Helen Lewis both appear to be Gen X, sort of younger end of Gen X age.
Yeah.
They then got on to the subject of video games, because he had, I think, written about video games in the past, and Helen Lewis does play them. Mm. And the short version of the conversation was Helen Lewis going, I play Bioshock a lot. I really like Bioshock 1. I thought it was very good and it was really innovative. I haven't played any games that are like Bioshock since. Nothing between the next statement, which was, I think games are uninnovative and bad now and are a disappointment as a medium. And then the author said, yes, I agree.
Yeah.
And
I will say that they did kind of clarify that... There was a point in the podcast where they both sort of acknowledged that they don't really play games as much, so maybe they aren't the best people to speak about it. And I want to say up front, I may be contradicting what you've got in mind for this podcast, Gal.
Yeah.
This is not us calling out the New Statesman of how dare you with your wrong content. This is the spurring of an idea that we thought it'd be interesting if we discussed the structure of the video game industry at large. Because they made a lot of statements where they compared it to the movie industry, and was sort of like, oh, it's kind of, you know, there's too much money in it now, and it's gotten into this sort of, like, very franchise-driven, everything's very homogenous idea, because Helen Lewis said that she played Far Cry 5, and it was very similar to other Far Cries, to which I'm like, well, yeah, sure, you know.
Okay, well, before we continue,
yes.
Normally when I announce the topic, it's like a sentence, and then I start the timer, and I've not started the timer yet.
I'm glad
that
you did.
You announcing the
topic. Yeah. I will say, today is the 27th of January 2019 when we're recording. If you want to listen to the New Statesman podcast for context, the section in question commences from about 25 minutes into the show. It's their most recent episode of the New Statesman podcast. It's worth listening just so you have the full context. Feel free to go away and come back. Welcome back. Jim, do you want to smash that?
I know, I already did whilst you were speaking, because I'm like
we gotta get
one minute over an hour is just like, that's just going to alienate our one audience member.
Yeah. Jim, me and Callum off mic had a bit of a discussion about this, you know, when we were thinking we should make this a podcast topic. What was your reaction to the discussion heard on the New Statesman podcast?
Right, well, because this is a bit intimidating, because you might have already decided what your opinion is on this, and now I have to, like, go into this blind saying, this is what I think, and you'd be like, wrong! But it was, yeah, mixed feelings, because on the one hand, they were like, yes, it's true that certain areas of the gaming industry have stagnated, like the middle industry have just sort of dropped out, and I think it is true that, like, I have expressed the opinion before that I am disappointed by the amount of innovation that is happening. Although I think that no innovation is happening, but I just sort of, like, look at, GTA popularized this free-roaming environment, open-world environment as a sort of game format. And everyone was like, oh, that's really popular, let's do that. I'm like, yeah, great, there's lots of other things that we can apply this game format to. And they're like, yeah, so, like, instead of a West Coast city in America with crime as a theme, we could do an East Coast city in America with crime as a theme.
And this time you can go up a mountain.
Yeah, and I'm just like, where is my sci-fi open world game with the flying cars? And like, how long did it take Grand Theft Auto, Rockstar, to just go, wait a minute, we could also do this as a Western? And everyone else goes, oh yeah, you can also do it as a Western. It's like, why did no one else do that before?
And you can guarantee there were lots of people behind the scenes at Rockstar up until the development of Red Dead Redemption being like, could we do it in other contexts? And like, people at Rockstar being like, no!
They probably look, I mean, just as a, I feel that this isn't the most direct way into the topic, but I think it's something that I've just thought about, is that what's interesting is you had, back in like the early 2000s, when GTA 3 Vice City was sort of like the hot new shit at the time. Does anyone else remember the video game The Getaway?
I knew it was going to be The Getaway.
Because The Getaway is legitimately, it's not very good, but it does a lot of really interesting things in terms of how it approaches the basic open world crime thriller game design model. It's like, you have super low health, there's no mini-map, you have to navigate by actually knowing where things are, and your car does indications to tell you when to turn left and right when you're going to a specific place. You're much more story-driven and everything, and you're just a guy. You're not like a crazy guy, you're not like this big, colourful character. It's like, you're just a dude who happens to have been caught up in this whole Lock, Stock and Two Smoking Barrels kind of thing. And it didn't do incredibly well because it was weird and difficult, and lots of people found it very, very confusing because it explains basically nothing. So I think what we're kind of seeing with video games at the moment is, at least in AAA space terms, there's a big fear, and this is the thing they mentioned on the New Statesman podcast, that one of the biggest barriers for video games as a medium for people to be able to explore it freely is skill and execution and just familiarity. Like, my mum has played video games, and the thing that she has to do, which, you know, none of us have to do, is constantly be like, huh? I'm looking at a fake controller in my hands, audio listeners. Like, constantly not being aware of where the buttons are and not being able to complete things and thereby not being able to advance. And for people who are more video game au fait, I feel like that's something that we expect. We expect a certain level of difficulty, we expect some challenge or whatever that allows us to sort of feel a sense of progression, you know, tactility or something.
Yeah, I do think it's, I've mixed things about that, because on the one hand I'm a big sort of pusher for, I think one of the great things about like the arts is that there is truly no barrier to entry to it, everyone should be able to do it, says the person who spent 8 years in education in it, but like, you know, it's like, but the point is like, that's the best, one of the best things about it. That said, I do think, and this came up again on the New Statesman podcast, I think it comes up, there are some times when people point to a thing and they're like, I couldn't access this thing for reasons that they push on the product or art or medium, when in fact it's on them. The example I would use is, like, there's a point in the podcast where they bring up games like Bloodborne and Dark Souls. And they basically say, like, you know, they're games that are incredibly punishing and incredibly hard. And then Helen Lewis turns around and says, well, I think that those are games that are very appealing when you're young, when you have your whole life stretched out ahead of you and it seems like you have lots of time. When you're older, you really just want sleep. Now, as someone myself who picked up Bloodborne and just went, nope, and likes to troll by saying it's a bad game, but it's obviously not a bad game. It's obviously a spectacularly good one. Yeah. It's just not for me. That's actually quite disingenuous, because it's like, well, I know Helen Lewis watches a lot of theatre every week because she says so on the podcast. If she, and I'm not saying she should, if she chose to stop going to the theatre and just play Dark Souls all the time, she would probably be quite good at Dark Souls by now.
Yeah.
But she chooses not to. She chooses to spend her time differently. And that's fine. You don't have to. I know that the reason I can't get into Bloodborne is because I choose to spend my time seeing a lot of movies in the cinema and playing games with, which are more accessible, like Zelda and Smash and whatever.
Yeah.
And that's fine. But I also don't point at Bloodborne sincerely and go, this is hard and I can't do it. And therefore, that's on it. Or that the people who do play it are somehow lacking. And that, but it's in the same way that when people say, there's no good music these days, and it's like, no, you just haven't listened to any. It's like,
well, yeah, like my mum said that to me as well. She's like, oh, it's amazing that you only listen to music like from when I was a teenager. It's like, well, I do listen to music from when you were a teenager, because music was, you know, had a golden age back then. But that doesn't mean I don't also listen to music that has been made now. Mm. And, you know, I listen to, like, classical music as well. And I mean, like, oh, like, you could do gatekeep Beethoven in the same way.
Let's be real. Since Bach died, everything's just been shit.
Nothing's been going on.
It's just been... Yeah, I mean, it's like the silly Sight and Sound magazine rule of, like, you can't like it until 50 years' time. Like, after 50 years' time, it's okay to think it's good.
With video games, though, I think it's a telling thing about the youth of the medium that there seems to be a certain supposition that... if you like video games as a cohesive thing, that means you must like all of them, because they're all the same. It's like someone who enjoys, say, for example, to use Helen Lewis's example, if you enjoyed Bioshock 1, which is a good game, you might not enjoy Dark Souls, which is also a good game, because they're two very different games. It's like me saying, oh, Jim, you like movies. You must love Birth of a Nation. You know, whereas there's like, there's, you know, those things are not... While Birth of a Nation is a movie, it's not the same as, say, fucking Spider-Man. Like, those are two very different things, and I wouldn't expect, just because someone has an interest in movies, to find those things of equal artistic value
This is the problem with the idea of gamer as an identity.
Oh, boy.
And the fact that, yeah, it's, like... Because we don't do that with any other form of media. Like, some people might say, like, oh, I'm a film fan, I'm a film buff.
Or I like books.
Yeah.
You know, I read them.
But no one says, like, no one really puts their identity around a piece of media, or a format of media in the same way that gamers do.
Well, equally, and also, no media necessarily tries to cultivate a sense of identity as much as game companies do. Like, you had Sony doing the whole, like, this is for the players and stuff, and, like, you know, like,
imagine like a film studio going, like, this is for the film goers. It's like, well, of course it is.
Yeah,
who else would it be for?
That's why we're here.
I would say that Marvel tries to cultivate, movies do it within niches. They don't do it for the medium as a whole. Like, they will cultivate, like, they really do cultivate, like, fan culture around Marvel, or like independent film with nauseating results, cultivate cinephile culture.
Yeah.
Frankly, only slightly a notch above paedophiles in how repulsive they are. Utter wankers. And like, in the same way.
Nice non controversial take from Callum.
In
so
the
far.
Same way, like.
You remember you are on mic.
Okay. Cinephiles are not as bad as paedophiles. Yeah. Just to be clear, well,
you didn't say they were, you just said no.
I'm just saying they both make me sick. Just one makes me much more sick than the other. Paedophiles, they make me more sick. Anyway, you look at people who read books, like, yes, there are not really people who are like, I read books and that's my identity, and it's not marketed
I'm
the same
a
way.
Reader.
Right. However, things are marketed as literary to literary people. And so, you know, like, someone would be like, I am a bore who reads The New Yorker all the time and likes to tell people about that too much. Like, you know, that's normally someone who reads a certain type of book. So it's like, it's just maybe because games are newer as a medium, people still feel it's okay to be like, gamers, one thing, in the same way that you were like, like video. Yeah, it's basically what you said. Like,
but also the identity of gamers sort of associated with youth. Like, the fact that my mum says, like, you're 30 years old now, should you really still be playing games? And it's like,
does she say that?
She said that. I'd say, like, Mum, like, do you still watch films? You still watch books? Like, why are games different just because they're a younger medium? Mm. And it's like, and that's the thing. If you had any experience of playing games, you would know. It's like, oh, this isn't an art form purely for children.
Mm. But, to get back to the context of the state and shape of the current video game industry, though, as Jim mentioned, it's a thing that I think we've mentioned on the podcast multiple times previously, that over the last, like, 5-10 years, we have seen the middleware area of video games, which is, like, higher production values and budget than an indie title, but nowhere near the level of polish and resources that a AAA title has. That's kind of ceased to be as economically viable, I think. Which, for me, I felt was sort of a little bit of a disappointment, because AAA tends to be not only the face of video gaming as a thing, you know, you have your franchise titles, your Call of Duties, whatever. That kind of stuff doesn't really take any risks. It goes with what it knows, and it appeals to the broadest possible market possible. Whereas an indie title usually is made by a very, very small team on very, very small resources, and it will be, in many ways, niche, less accessible, sometimes very, very difficult, sometimes very, very challenging, and very, very interesting, but not really the kind of thing that you're sort of going to be, like, trying to push as something that should be played by absolutely everybody. Like the Binding of Isaac, for example. Like, I'd have a hard time recommending that to people who don't really know what to expect from it. Because it's like, it's a roguelike, it's effectively a form of twin stick shooter, it deals with a lot of really intense themes of domestic abuse and religion, it's very grimy, it's got a lot of, like, you know, blood, poop, and, like, sadness and tears and, like, child abuse stuff in it. And it's very, very indie game. It's very, very interesting, but it's also, like, not what everybody wants. But at the same time, I wouldn't necessarily recommend someone automatically, like, oh, obviously you want to play the new Call of Duty because, like, industrial military complex and, like, the fetishization of weaponry and the fact that it's all kind of stale. I would like to have stuff like you had back in the sort of mid period of the PlayStation 3 / the PlayStation 2, when you had much more titles that had just enough budget to have some polish and some accessibility, but were unafraid to be experimental, you know? Something like Killer 7, like, or other Suda 51 games, like, he can still kind of get away with it because he'll do weird, bizarre things, and he has enough money because he basically runs his own studio to put out things that are much more, like, sort of solid and, you know, meatier than rather a smaller indie title.
I think it also goes beyond that. It's not, yes, what you said is 100% true about that middle market dropping out, but then there's also the fact that actually just games that are, like, a straightforward, like, story that you play as a single player but costs a lot of money to make, studios just won't touch them with a fucking barge pole. Like, the story of, like, Star Wars 1313, which was, for those people who don't know, it was a game that was in development at LucasArts. It was basically Uncharted, but in Star Wars. It was like, you played a bounty hunter, you had a crew of people around you. Which, sure. You look at that, you just think, that's basically printing money.
Yep.
Like, people would love to play that. Of course it's a good idea. There are two reasons. The initial reason that it ran into problems was it was a game that was happening during LucasArts going from George Lucas to Disney.
Right.
So that and one of the things, who knows whether it's Disney, who knows whether it's other people, basically they turned around and went, this is not a multiplayer game, this is not a game as service.
This is EA. They own the rights to video games for Star Wars. Yeah. Jim Sterling actually did an episode about this last week. He pointed out that over a 8-year period, they've put out 2 Star Wars games and cancelled 3, some of which sounded very interesting, and actually closed studios because of it. And whereas when the rights were more open prior to, I think it was 2003, I think, no, 2005, over the same 8-year period, you had like 7 games come out. All of varying qualities and different kinds of stuff, but you were actually getting content. And Star Wars Battlefield and Star Wars Battlefield 2, Battlefield 1, when it came out, this is modern era of Battlefield, it was incomplete, was riddled with microtransactions, it pissed off an awful lot of the players, and then they tried to fix things with Battlefront 2, adding in a story mode stuff, which created even more problems and controversy because it wasn't very good and it wasn't finished. And sorry, I've completely T-bugged your point there, but
The thing being that one of the reasons the game was that Star Wars 1313, there's like a longer thing about it in the book Blood, Sweat and Pixels, which is a great book. But one of the reasons it was killed was because they were like, this is not a game of service, this is not multiplayer, this is just a single player story. It's a person going on an adventure in the world of Star Wars.
How dull.
And who wants that?
I don't want that.
We can't sell it. And I'm just like,
I found that completely baffling because it's not as if the single player game market went anywhere.
God of War is a big testament to the fact that duo, and Marvel Spider-Man as well.
Mm.
Both single player experiences. Well,
all single player experiences now have to be open world.
God of War wasn't.
Was
really.
It not?
No, God of War 4 or Dad of Boy. Dad of Boy is open-ish in the sense that you can go to places, but the beats of the story, you don't have like as much in the way of sort of like Spider-Man is like you can just roam around and swing and find little side quests and incidental stuff like that. But it's very sort of tightly focused. I actually saw an interesting interview on NoClip with the director of Dad of Boy. And he said one of the things, he gave an analogy which I thought was quite interesting, which he used the analogy of comparing the video game industry to the film industry. And he said that in the really early phases of film, a lot of the stuff that was being made, like Georges Méliès and stuff like that, it was more look at what we can do, and like the technological aspects and a lot of like making things move, making people's heads fly off, doing a lot of special effects stuff to sort of show, look how much we can do in this medium. And he said, I feel like that video games as a art form is only just starting to get beyond that. Like we've finally gotten to the point where the discourse is getting to, why do we value length in video games as a thing? Like, we don't really do that in any other medium. It's like, oh, this book's only 45 pages. Whoa, my. You know, we don't. This movie is only 90 minutes long. That's not really worth your money. Whereas we do that with games.
Yeah, and it's especially weird because, like, if you keep releasing games that are longer and longer and longer, that are prided on how much content there is in there, that just means people have less time to play games because every game they play is a massive investment.
Yeah. I mean, then you look at No Man's Sky, where you have procedurally generated, functionally infinite content, but it just gets shallower and you can't have the same depth or interesting or, like, real character moments if you're prioritizing just having a massive space. Like, look at the Just Cause games.
Yeah.
Absurdly gigantic maps. Not really that much in them, to be honest.
The Assassin's Creed games as well. It doesn't help that they release so many of them so frequently, but also not as bad as Just Cause, but often the game content is actually spread quite thinly. I've not played any of the last two. I've heard it's still the same. It's sort of true of them. It certainly was true of Syndicate. Even though I enjoyed Syndicate, but there was a lot of like, oh, this is just the same mission again, but over here now.
It was one of I think the comparison to the film industry is apt, but one thing, and again, this isn't just ragging on the New Statesman podcast, because it's the thing I've heard said in many other places, is the author that Helen Oates is interviewing says, what bothers me about games is that they've gone from an early stage in infancy and have jumped now forward to the big franchise, you know, money-making stage, and the middle period that, say, film had has been skipped, and it's like, well, sorry to actually. But, you know, one of the few things I am qualified on is film, and you do not know your film history there, because actually, what happened after the golden age of Hollywood was Hollywood kept cranking. This is a conversation we did, Nick and I did have off mic, and I'm sort of rerunning it, but Hollywood, you know, kept cranking out music. It was musicals and westerns, and just being like, these made money before, why are they not making money now? And because, like, the economic model had changed, people's interests had changed, like, television was starting to come into the world, and so people just didn't want them anymore. And therefore, because all the money was going into those movies and they were just churning out what today we would call franchises, it then sort of, first of all, from the sort of like B-movie, flea pit cinemas, and then very slowly the film industry starting to cotton onto this, it then created a space for people to make weirder stuff. Which, and then the cinemas were starting to put that stuff on because they wanted something that people were willing to watch and something that made money. And that's what led to the generation of filmmakers of like Scorsese, Coppola, Brian De Palma, Spielberg. That's what they came from. If you look at what their origins are, most of them made their first movies with Roger Corman or someone equivalent to him, someone on the weirder end whose movies would never have made money 10 years before. But because the franchise movie, quite a lot of franchises, were doing so badly, that created a market for them. If you actually look at the video game industry, because everything is games as, you know, games as service, huge, you know, everything has to be Overwatch or whatever.
Yeah. GTA is the most lucrative media thing.
Yeah, exactly.
Ever.
No,
it's, like, it's fucking nuts how much money there is flowing around in the
industry. Especially considering how long it's been since a GTA game was released.
I know, well, GTA Online, they don't need to. They've done regular content upgrades for that, and it's made tons of
money. Yeah, and the content is just like, throw a car at the moon and expansion pack. It's not like, you know, it doesn't even resemble the game that came on the disc. Yeah. And like, and because everything is that, it has created a space, which also, again, comes from, like, changing nature of the medium. So in the same way film is being informed by television, you know, indie games are more accessible because of the online market. There is, you know, indie games are now stepping in to fill that gap.
Yeah.
Are they making GTA money? No. But you are seeing things like, you know, the really big ones like Stardew Valley, like, a lot of people, like, play them. And so I think there are really parallels to the film industry that people are actually missing. And it is a bit of, like, there's a bit of, like, a, you know, remember when vibe to it, which is like, no, if you just take the time to look at these two situations, they're very, very similar.
Mm. It's just, it's happening a lot faster. I think technology is moving. And also, I think one of the things that's interesting is that with this current generation, right, I don't know if I'll necessarily have both of you agree with me on this, is that I feel like with the PS4 generation that we're in now, the level of graphical fidelity and stuff like that we're getting now has reached what I feel is sort of a plateau, where it's like, I feel like a lot of titles are thinking, the quest for absolute realism, which has been a sort of holy grail ever since, you know, you go back to the PS1 and we started modelling with 3D polygons and stuff, and once we had Lara Croft and her triangle-shaped boobs, we were like, well, we have to model them perfectly now. This is a quest to make the perfect representation of a physical human. And I think when you look at, like, the in-game assets for something like The Last of Us 2, it's The Last of Us, right? Yeah. Mm. The Last of Us 2. I'm like, that's literally, it's motion-captured actors. It's really, really convincing stuff that, you know, in some cases, you look at it, like, the trailers for Death Stranding, the first time I watched it, I was sort of like, I know this is CGI, but my brain is kind of going a bit, hold on a minute. That's a Norman Reedus right there. It's just Norman Reedus doing Norman Reedus stuff with an invisible baby. Like, I feel like that with the next generation, power level is going to jump up, right? But I feel like there's a limit to how much more polishing you can do. And I think, if anything, this is going to have to drive creators to do more experimental, different aesthetics or choices, because they've got all this extra hardware to play around with, presumably. But there's not a very easy way to say, look, here's how beautiful this thing can look. Because I remember when on the PlayStation 2, did you guys see the when Final Fantasy X came out?
Yeah.
And how people were like, what the fuck? Because that was like sequel to Final Fantasy 9, where everything's still a bit polygonal, still a bit like, you know, big pixels on the screen and stuff. And then Final Fantasy X comes out, it's full 3D, everyone looks vaguely human and stuff. And now it looks really dated, you know, if you go back to it. But I think we've now reached a point where I can't fully conceive of, one, how you would make something more real, and two, why you would need to.
I do agree with you. I mean, I am also aware that there was a time when I looked at Tony Hawk's Pro Skater 2 and I was like, well, you can't really do any better than that. And boy, how wrong I was. I mean, I think that there is still ways that you can improve on graphics, like certainly in terms of like things like reflections and lighting and that sort of thing. And yeah, so it's like I think graphics can still improve, and like we'll look at graphics in the future and be like, oh yeah, graphics today do look dated.
Yeah.
However, I do take your point that there is a limit to that. Like as well.
And it's less of a draw than it was.
That's the thing. Like I think you do reach a point where, like, let's say if it's possible to measure like graphics, if give it a figure.
IGN.com, 5 out of 5 for graphics.
I think like if you can measure like graphical quality, there like I think there is a limit to like the dividends you get. So like, oh, say here's a 5, you double it to a 10, and you're like, oh my god, that looks so much better. But then you do it to a 20, and it's like, well, that the difference between a 20 and a 10 isn't as effective as the difference between a 10 and a 5.
Mm.
Just because there's a limit to how much our eyes can see, a limit to how much our like brains interpret from what we look at. Like once we like, you know, looking at Lara, like original Lara Croft, you can say like, yeah, I can see that resembles a person. I'm not in any doubt that that is not a person.
Yeah.
But then you look at Lara Croft now, it's just like, yeah, I can, you can tell it's not real, but you're like, yeah, that is like, that is a perfectly animated human. And like, if you were to say apply the same difference between those two Lara Crofts to the current Lara Croft to something new, that isn't going to be as impressive a difference.
Yeah,
it's it works the same with televisions as well. Mm. Like they're like
4K.
Like, yeah, well, yeah, the difference between HD and SD, I think, is quite striking. My sister can't tell the difference, but we'll ignore her. But then, like, and then the difference between HD and 4K, you can probably notice, but then you get to the point, like, because I think it's 16K, or is it, was it 40K? A certain number of K that we're nearly at the limit of how much our eyes can see.
Wow.
And you know, and they could probably keep exceeding that, but by that point there will be no point.
Yeah.
Because we physically will not be able to tell the difference.
There'll be a production point, because you'll be able to you'll be able to like do a lot more in post if you were filming in 1000K, because I guess you'd have to light it. You could like slap it in a wide and then just decide later what should you
do. One thing I want to say about just a discourse thing is I think a healthy thing for the way that people talk about video games in terms of an evolving medium is not helped by the fact that a lot of reviews, like we say, how do you quantify graphics?
Mm.
I think that's a bad misnomer that leads people to the idea that there's a sort of objective idea of good graphics versus bad graphics. A better term, I think, would be art direction.
Yeah, well, people don't, like, not enough is said about the fact that aesthetic is way more important than graphical quality.
Yeah.
Like, if you look at Just Cause 2, I think, specifically, the graphical fidelity of the graphics are fine, but the aesthetic is really bland.
Mm.
And it looks nowhere near as interesting as, let's say, the original Spyro the Dragon game on PS1. Because that game, like, graphical fidelity is low, but it has a strong aesthetic, and it needed to compensate for that. I think
The fact that most of your people were made out of giant triangles.
Yeah. And I think like, actually, maybe that's part of the, yeah, I think that you get more creativity when you're working under limitations.
Mm.
And so that's why maybe the games of our childhood, now this may just be nostalgia talking, but like those games, like, I tend to be more creative in terms of their aesthetics, because they had to do that to compensate for the limitations of the medium.
Well, it's also, there is a thing where technological barriers are great for the people who hold power in a medium. Because if you can't, like, if most people can't do something,
yeah,
and people with money can do it, then they can go, well, this is the reason we exist. Any questions?
Hmm.
Whereas if people start to value that thing less, it allows other voices to come in. And often the gatekeepers of an industry will get panicky about that.
Yeah.
Because it's like, well, if just anyone can make a game, then what's the point of EA Games? And it's like, yeah, good question. Like,
this is what you saw, and I think it was, I want to say 2014, I think, at E3, where Sony made a big point of saying, we have signed on 15 independent studios to come and make indie games for us.
Mm.
Because I think in that same way, that was around the time that the indie market was really gathering steam and getting a lot of press attention, as we saw the collapse of the middle of the market, and lots of people being like, oh my god, well, look at all these tiny games that like one guy has made. And now you have much larger studios offering small studios or independent developers and stuff like that the very risky thing of saying, hey, we'll give you financial security and resources to make your game better, but you work for us and we own it, and also we can fold you up, which is what's happened with, like, EA has specifically got a history of buying up studios because they've just made something pretty cool, and then shutting them down because they're unable to necessarily meet the absurd demands of, like, you know, the shareholders of EA.
Oh, I mean, Bungie just split from Activision and took Destiny with them.
Yeah.
And it's like, I mean, Destiny's a mess, but it's a mess that is played by millions worldwide.
Mm.
And it's very, I mean, it's a brave move on their part, but it also says something about, like, working with those big companies. And I know that you weren't endorsing it, I'm just saying coming off it.
Oh, of course.
Like, the company that says, we're going to buy 15 of these game studios, and just like, you know, unless that big company, which some do, have a great track record of creativity,
yep,
it rings of like a billionaire's compromise to me. Of it's like, no, don't worry, we're nice.
Yeah.
We spent all this money on this. We're supportive of indie games. It's like, sometimes you need voices outside those big companies. Again, Stardew Valley, now one of the runaway successes of video games, literally existed because the people who made Harvest Moon were like, there's no point in making Harvest Moon because no one wants it. Yeah. No one would play it if you made that, so don't make it. And then the guy was like, no, fuck this, I want to make Harvest Moon. And he made Harvest Moon without the brand recognition of Harvest Moon.
Yep.
And then now more people are probably playing it than they would have done if Harvest Moon had come out.
Yeah, because it's a new take on a familiar thing. Which
well, it's not even a new take. It's just, it's very, very, very similar. Like, it's got a bit of a modern sensibility and whatever, but like presumably a remake would have done as well. That's the most interesting one, because it's like, the game studio was just wrong. Like, they were just stuck in groupthink and were just like wrong about this particular thing and didn't have enough of a connection with their audience. And
Well, I find that I think this is a problem in film as well. Is like the relationship between the creatives and the executives. I wish I had better words for that because it makes me feel a bit cringy. Especially, like, I don't normally like. It's very easy to sort of like punch up as, oh, executives don't know what they're talking about, because sometimes they do. But I do think there's a sort of fundamental difference in the way that these two tribes sort of look at producing art, in that, like, you know, creatives want to make something new, they want to contribute something, they want to respond to things that they've seen in new and interesting ways, whereas executives, you know, it's a business, they want to make money, and so they look at market trends and they say, well, this is what's working now, so this is what we have to do. And sometimes that's true, like, you know, oh, no one's gonna like invest in this wacky idea you have. But there's sometimes as well where they're just like, well, this is what's doing well now, so we have to keep doing it, not realizing that they're killing it. Mm. And not realizing that the things that make the most money are the runaway successes. Deadpool makes a whole ton of money, and now everyone's trying to make Deadpool. And Warner Brothers, well, quick, we have to tweak Suicide Squad so it's more like Deadpool. And it's like, well, that's not going to work.
I was going to say, the obvious example is Fortnite.
Yeah.
Like, what, PUBG, and then Fortnite, and then everyone's like, oh shit, we need to have a battle royale.
Yeah, now everyone's doing that, not realizing, like,
it's already done, like, no one cares anymore. It's like, Fortnite is a runaway giga monster of a success that's like a once in a generation level thing, because it's absurdly popular and makes absurd amounts of money. And PUBG is doing alright, because, you know, it's got that more sort of quote unquote hardcore crowd behind it, because it's the original, it's much more serious than the silly dancing Fortnite doing the floss. you know, this is a game for men, not for boys. And
those... You have a very high IQ to understand PUBG.
Oh, you do. I tried to friggin' do copyright claims on a frying pan as like a fundamental mechanic. I'm like, no, that's not okay. But what you then have is that I think that because of the speed at which the games industry moves, and in some ways I honestly feel like the games industry moves faster than the film industry in many ways. I think the film industry, because it's like a more established kind of thing, takes a little bit longer to sort of properly curve around on like following a trend or something like that. Whereas because game development is used to making things faster and making bigger things quicker, I feel like there's a lot more of snap decision making in the process, and because it's a more sort of, because you can change technically anything at almost any point. Like, one of the key examples, like Bioshock Infinite, that if you're listening to Danny O'Dwyer and over at Noclip, if you ever listen to this, please, I'm going to tweet him about this later actually. if he could get to talk to the people at Insomniac Games who were working on Bioshock Infinite, I want to know what happened. Because I went to BAFTA Gaming Question Time, where Ken Levine was there talking about Bioshock Infinite shortly before it came out. And he talked a lot about Elizabeth as a character and how she functioned as like this sort of support system and everything, and also the you know, the way that she impacted the narrative. A thing he said that was fascinating to me is he was like, yeah, the idea of her using dimensional tears was a very last minute idea. Now, without going into spoilers, that's literally the fucking plot of Bioshock Infinite. And I'm like, so what was the game before that? What, you know, did you have that you either didn't believe in enough, or you believed in the tears enough to sort of say, we want to do this much more kind of cosmic, you know, going into parallel realities kind of thing? What was the game before? Because the original, one of the first gameplay trailers showed a lot more stuff about faction-based combat, a lot more stuff about using your plasmids in different ways to sort of have different effects, and she would work with you in that way, and seemed to be a bit more directly political. And a lot, while there was a lot of, you know, political commentary within Bioshock Infinite, I feel a lot of it was pushed aside to make room for the larger sci-fi concept of, like, you know, multiple reality stuff. And film can't do that. Film can't, you can't film everything in production and be like, okay, we've got all the bits, now we need to completely change the plot and the central conceit of the film.
Well,
boys, please educate me. Both of you know much more about this than I do.
Mulholland Drive is a recut TV pilot. So Mulholland Drive was a... I do think... I mean, it's also my favourite film. but Mulholland Drive is like a really good example of that, where Mulholland Drive was basically shot as like Twin Peaks, but set in LA.
Right.
It was a one-hour pilot. If you've seen Mulholland Drive, it's like... Sorry, if you've seen Mulholland Drive, like, there are sort of tonal shifts in it that in the film are explained, but if you took them... Yeah, it was basically very tonally similar to Twin Peaks, but Twin Peaks is different from Mulholland Drive. In the broadest possible terms, Mulholland Drive is quote-unquote darker than Twin Peaks is on an average episode.
Right.
By quite a lot. And basically, Mulholland Drive, as a TV pilot, got made. It got shown to... This is sort of David Lynch's take on it, but it's been verified. It got shown to an executive who, according to David Lynch, watched it on a small TV from across the other side of a long room while drinking coffee and answering a phone call. He watched it and went, no, we don't want to make this. And then David Lynch, being David Lynch, was like, oh, I'm going to, like, blah, blah, go to Paris, blah, blah, and, like, stormed off in a huff. And then eventually, like, wanted to do something else, couldn't get that project made, and then started thinking about basically an extra third-ish that he could put on Mulholland Drive, where he could add a new storyline to it, and therefore it would make them, it would make it work as a movie.
Right.
I think also someone just said to him, why didn't you do it as a movie? And then he then invest, and then so he has this idea, he goes back to investigate, but all the sets have been destroyed. Every plot, every prop is gone, and he's like, oh fuck. So then he has to make the thing even more extreme, like the weirdness in it. And, like, everything has a point to it, and it could have been so bad, but it was...
styled it out.
Well, it's not even a case of... I mean, not to be, like, a stand for it, but it is, like, one of the few things I will be. It isn't just a case of style. Not that style isn't hard to do or substantial, but it is, like, he came up with a great story.
Yeah.
To, like, make these, this rebuilt Frankenstein thing actually be a way better thing.
Yeah.
And that does happen a lot. Like, no, most people don't have the privilege of, like, 90s, Dave, early 2000s David Lynch to be able to be, like, swan in and demand more money and get it.
Mm.
But, I mean, you also, like, you can... You have to... It has to be said that how much you can change a film in the edit. And the best example of this is the original Star Wars. Because that film... Like, yeah, the George Lucas showed that film to a bunch of his, like, friends, which included Steven Spielberg, so it's like this is why George Lucas has a career, because these people were his friends. But then his wife at the time basically recut the film and fixed it. A few story things she changed. Like, originally there was much more about Luke in the beginning, like, not related to the battle that was going on above Tatooine, but him just reacting to it, got rid of that because he's not relevant yet. But the main thing that she did was... the final battle where they go to destroy the Death Star in the original cut of the film, the cut that was shot, the Death Star is not about to destroy the Rebel base. Basically the Rebels go to where the Death Star is and just destroy it. And it's sort of like, well, this just seems like a act of terror rather than like them
defensive
fight.
Yeah. Being the good guys,
and so yeah, so if you watch the final act of Star Wars, you will notice that all reference to the Death Star, like, approaching the Rebel base and going, you know, going around this planet in order to destroy it, is all like, if it's in dialogue, it's mentioned by someone off screen. It's like a tannoy that someone says on this graphic that they've added after the fact. You'll also notice, like, there's a scene with, like, Tarkin, like approaching and, like, sort of saying, oh, we're approaching the Rebel base. You notice that scene of him, like, sort of walking onto the bridge is actually the beginning of the shot when he comes onto the bridge, when Leia is brought onto the bridge and they destroy Alderaan. Like, you can actually find, like, that shot, like, was cut, it begins, like... In the scene with Leia, it begins at one point, but you realise if you take this shot that's now in the end of the film,
it's just
put it at the front, it's just a continuation. Yeah, it's like, oh, yeah, so...
That's clever.
Yeah, and all these shots of Tarkin, like, you never see him talk about the Rebel base with on his face. It was all just clever cutting around stuff.
And additional voiceover and stuff.
Yeah, and just by reframing the scene in this way that, oh, now these people are fighting for their lives, it completely changes the way you read that.
Yeah, I mean, like, even in, more recent thing, the Vice, the new movie about Dick Cheney that just came out, I think it was earlier in the US, but it just came out in the UK. Because, fortunately for the film, Dick Cheney is a man who wears, like, grey suits a lot. And there are quite a few times in the movie where I'm like, I think that's actually a shot from the scene before that was 3 years ago, but because all this takes place in political offices and you always wear the same thing, you've just chopped that around quite cleverly and, like, that's fine, it works, but you definitely did it. And you've changed the script quite a bit.
So, yeah, video games.
Sorry, I didn't mean to tangents and something. No, it's... Yeah, I feel like there is a lot of money and there is a lot of trend chasing, I think it's the unending sea of games that is Steam is a testament to, if you want to find things that are, you know, if you want the entry point where people can just make a thing and go, you know, there it is. You can just find that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's good, sometimes it's terrible. You know, or you have stuff like something like Undertale, for example, is... I don't know how you'd necessarily equate that in the same way that it's sort of... It harkens back to an era of games that doesn't really exist anymore, but specifically does things that change how you think about the way that those games function. It's a lot more meta-reflexive commentary, which I think... Is one of those things that's more sort of unique to games, is the fact that because you can have, like, you know, reflective kind of films where you sort of do, like, a harken back to previous genre pieces and stuff like that. But because you're literally experiencing them, if you want someone to feel like, oh, it's like I'm playing Mega Man, you can just make how Mega Man was and, like, have that thing be a literal experience that happens to people.
But then there's something, we've done a whole podcast on this, of how I think, like, open world games are, like, not exploring the fullest extent of how they could be telling their narratives. Mm. And, yeah, so it's like, but so, yeah, I sort of agree that there is this, that games are not as, video games are not as creative as they could be. Or at least, certainly at least, there is a ton of untapped potential that hasn't been mined yet, and I think a lot of people, even within the gaming industry, don't realise. And certainly, that's maybe also because, like, gaming as a medium doesn't have the same level as respect as other mediums do, despite the fact that it's like money wise bigger than all of them.
I was interested actually with the thing that Hideo Kojima said about Death Stranding,
is
because he's, you know, as far as we know, Death Stranding is just a series of interesting trailers. We've got a very, very, very loose idea of how basic gameplay is. We know that it's third person, it's possibly open worldish. It's got elements similar to Dark Souls and the like, where if you die somewhere, then you can lose resources, but you can go get them back. But on his Twitter, Hideo Kojima has said many things to the effect of, in very vague terms, I think I've come up with an entirely new genre of game. And I think I've come up with mechanics that have never been done before. And he's talked a lot about how he wants to specifically make something genuinely transformative. Do you want us to wait while the car alarm's going off? Okay.
Thank you.
And it's part of that thing that, again, because games tend to feed off each other a lot, and it's much more obvious that, you know, because I remember I watched the Ryan Gosling movie Lost River, which I quite liked as a directorial debut. I was like, this is pretty good. It's good fun. And then I read some reviews, and a lot of people say, oh, well, he's taken this shot from this movie and this shot from that and blah, 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 blah. And it's like, you know, cribbing off all of these better directors. And I'm like, okay, so one, that doesn't make it bad. And two, I haven't watched like 15 of your specific very niche directors du jour to understand that. Whereas with a game, because I've played games, and if you put your hands on something, you get a sense for feel. You may, oh, this feels like Smash Bros. Oh, this feels like Street Fighter, or it feels like The Witcher, or something like that. There are conventions within that that give a greater sense of familiarity, I think, because it's, again, it's that haptic sense of, like, it's actually happening
well,
to you.
Well, also, yeah, because if you're playing a game, you have to learn how to play it. And so that means, like, one way that a lot of games sort of approach the barrier to entry is by using systems that are similar to other games, so you're already familiar with it. Mm. Like, all first-person shooters kind of work the same way. You get all these tons of conventions. Like, X is usually jump in a game where you can jump. Yeah. Circle is usually crouch in a game where you can crouch. R2 is normally fire if it's a first-person shooter.
Mm. But you do get games that occasionally mess with those expectations. And yeah. like something like Portal is technically an FPS, but it's an FPS puzzle.
Yeah. Solver? But then you get games like Mirror's Edge, which did this whole sort of like new control scheme for movement to do a sort of like wall running parkour like style gameplay, and I remember like looking at the like promotional media before that, where they're talking about like how this new innovative control scheme works and how it's supposed to be intuitive, how like the R and L buttons each correspond to like your left foot, left hand, right foot, right hand, so it seems intuitive, but it's still like it takes a lot more getting used to because you don't move in the same way that you move in other games.
Yeah, the focus is rather on the action of movement rather than movement being a thing that takes you where you need to go.
Yeah.
Because we're used to things where it's like, to move, you move the analog stick and that ambulates you in whatever way.
And you want to compare that to, say, another game where you can do parkour and free running, and that would be Assassin's Creed. And that's
just hold forward.
Yeah, hold forward. Well, hold a button and forward, and it will just move in that direction. No, no, not that way. No, I want to jump back. No, no, no.
And it's also like whatever obstacle your character. And the same with the Shadow of Mordor games as well. Is you just and your character will hop up a thing. He'll hop over some things. He'll jump off a thing into a thing. He'll jump out, keep running, vault over another thing, and you've not had to engage at all.
Yeah, which isn't necessarily bad. It's just like, here, you can do the fun thing without really needing much skill compared to, like, oh, no, this is a skill you have to learn.
Well, I would argue it's less about the skill of it. I think it's more that the focus in Assassin's Creed is sneaking around, moving quickly from place to place, and murdering dudes.
Yeah.
Whereas in Mirror's Edge, the focus is how fast can you effectively solve a physical puzzle of running, jumping, and everything, while having to engage with the movement a lot more.
Yeah.
It's a different focus, I think, rather than necessarily trying to work on accessibility.
Yeah, I do think that what you said about games' ability to be, I don't know if tactile is the word, but like you're having an experience and you're very, very involved in it.
It happens to you.
Yeah, it happens to you is a thing that people don't sort of put emphasis enough. I mean, I remember being in a class with a notoriously sort of belligerent and stick in the mud academic who, I mean, had written lots in that install. She's not a nice person. Why am I protecting her? And there was a point where she just came up and said she knows a lot of, broadly speaking, she knows a lot more about films than I do. However, she came out and said, she said at the end, and for some reason she came onto comic books. There's like a thing that film people who have read no comics ever will tell you to read Understanding Comics because it helps you understand film. I know. So basically she came out, she's bang on about Understanding Comics like they all do, and they go, essentially, comics are more primitive versions of film. They
Fuck
are
off.
Storyboards for film. Right, exactly. Christ. To which I, instead of just like angrily shitting my pants and leaving the room, which I very much wanted to do, I decided, I put my hand up and said, most passive aggressive I've ever been in my life, it could be argued that two things are crucially different about comics that make them not just primitive storyboards for film. One, the audience has control over the time at which they have control over time when they consume the images in comics. Two, in comics you can hold multiple shots in your head simultaneously at the same time, and the artist must play within that medium. And incredibly, she went, good point. And then went back to what she's doing, and I was just like, this is the only time that's ever happened to me. And it's just like, yeah, people don't, and in the same way, like, they look at comics and films and games and are like, well, all of these things, it's images in it. It's vaguely similar. Yeah. And also, like, it leads to bad games because people will be like, I just want to make a movie. You know, I just want to make a movie as a game, which is no fun to play.
Yeah.
You know, or it leads to, I don't know if games leads to bad, you know, bad movies, but like I think it leads to bad VR movies because people think that VR movies are the same as games and they're not.
Well, also, like, name a good video game movie adaptation.
Yeah, because it's...
Or either way.
Oh, it's good. Yeah, that's just because, like, when they adapt it, they don't understand that it's it fundamentally changes the experience, where it's like, if it's something that's happening to you rather than something that's happening in front of you.
Yeah. And even directors who love video games and get them, like, you know, Duncan Jones bloody loves Warcraft very, very much. It does not mean I don't want those 2.5 hours of my life back from watching the Warcraft film. It was the most entertaining bit was when the family of seven had an argument in front of the screen. Like, it was just terrible.
Well, and it's like, you look at, like, for example, the Tomb Raider movie, which I hear is, I've not seen it, but I hear it's fine. You know, it doesn't do anything particularly interesting. But the difference is that, you know, Jim, you've played through the most recent Tomb Raider games. You know, the modern era.
Yeah,
ones.
I didn't get through Shadow.
Yeah. But the thing is, in those games, you are Lara Croft for 30 hours.
Mm.
And that is a wealth of time to build characterization and character development and have specific, very nuanced moments that your audience is willing to go along with.
Mm.
Like, I completed Nier Automata recently, and to get to the end of that game, of the final ending of the game, took me approximately 35 hours. So I had been the characters in that game for approximately that length of time. So I feel I have a very specific understanding of those characters now because I've spent that much time with them. Whereas if you try and then condense that story into a 2-hour movie, to people who understand the original medium, it's going to feel shallow.
Mm.
Or it's going to, like you say, it's going to miss that exact nuance because, like, well, my Lara Croft wouldn't do that because I would play her differently.
Well, I think even if the Lara Croft on screen is doing exactly what you would do in the game,
yeah,
it's still a fundamental different experience. Where, like, if you are dropped into it, like the way the original new Tomb Raider begins. Oh, this is going to get confusing.
Tomb Raider 2016.
Yeah,
right?
That game begins is that, like, you're immediate, like, you have just, like, you, yeah, you've been shipped wrecked on this island and, like, it's, like, does this whole sort of time jump thing where, like, you start off after, like, because what happened to Lara is, like, she washes up on the shore and then is immediately abducted. It starts the moment after you've been abducted, mm, and you have to escape from this cave where this crazy man is keeping you hostage. And it just drops you into that situation. And it's fundamentally different to be like, oh, fuck, I've been abducted, to, like, oh, this person who I don't know yet has been abducted.
Mm.
Like, before you can begin to, like, feel about a character in a film, they have to build up empathy.
Mm.
But you don't have to do that in a video game because you have empathy for yourself immediately.
In the same, sorry.
Although I would say, as someone who's seen Tomb Raider, the film, I do think you need to create empathy in a different way with the film. I think that's absolutely right. That said, having seen someone who's seen the film adaptation of that, the first act prior to the island is a fucking snooze. Like, it's really not the strongest part of the film. It's sort of, it's backstory about Lara that 50% seems to be there so they can set up sequels later on with whatever the big bad organisation is in Tomb Raider and, like, stuff with her.
Trinity!
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah, but then Trinity isn't even mentioned in the first game.
Well, no. Yeah, and, like, stuff like that. And I'm just like, now you say that, I think, God, that movie would have been so much better if, like, the opening of the movie had just been smash cut, like, her on the island.
Mm.
And then we learn things about her through stuff that she finds and things that she does, as opposed to the start of the game, like, this is Lara Croft, she lives in London, she used to be rich, but she works as a bike messenger because hashtag gap year. And
I mean, because I'm aware we're getting near the end, I think an overall thing that we could sort of say, in the sort of more response to the New Statesman kind of thing, it's a key thing that I think a lot of people who don't have experience of video games, in the same way that, you know, Academic Lady was talking about comics, which he clearly doesn't have any experience of,
mm,
being a simplistic form of film. Because people know what films are, they go into video game space thinking that, like, I understand media, read film, therefore I will understand and have the correct expectations for this media, read film. And it's very difficult to get past that thing of saying, no, yet, there are things that games ape from film, and sometimes that works well, other times that doesn't work so well, but it's a fundamentally different sort of thing. And while there are a lot of, you know, similarities between the two industries, I think that, in many ways, I think games, and this isn't to disparage film in any way, whatever, and say, oh, film can't be iterated on anymore, put your cameras away, guys. Ever since Guardians of the Galaxy 2, there's no need to be another film! But in the same way, I think that, there, like you said, Jim, there's so much untapped creative possibility within video game space because everyone's experience of it is very, very unique. everyone's experience of it, it happens directly to them.
Mm.
And I think that can evoke a much stronger sense of empathy and communication than you can get through film. It's just that we don't yet know, one, how to cater those, you know, because you look at something like Depression Quest. Like, Depression Quest is a great example of a game that uses its mechanics to communicate a mental state, wherein it's basically a point-and-click text adventure where you make, you know, it's like, choose your own adventure, you can choose to do things. So it's like, you feel blah, 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 and here are your options. Get out of bed, do your job, stay in bed, eat loads of chocolate, whatever. And you click on the one that you want to do. And naturally, you try and be productive and do the things. But as you get further into the game and the depression worsens, you'll still have the option there, but there'll be a line through it, and you can't click on get out of bed. It's like the choice is taken away from you, much like it is for someone deep in the grips of, like, a depressive episode. And I'm like, that's, you know, it's hard to do that with film. You can't make someone recognize the, oh, I can't.
Mm.
It's not that I want, it's, I want to, I'm clicking on the thing, but it, the thing won't let me, so I have to do the other thing, which is to stay in bed. And it's really interesting the way that you can force emotional empathy in a way.
Mm. I was going to say one thing, sort of going right back to New States Podcast, that I also wanted to say, and sorry for like jumping onto another point, I think that the important discussion is, like, you know, where video games are at. However, I'd also say going back right to the thing of, it's the thing of, like, I don't listen to any new music. Also, there's no good new music. And it's like, well, it's like my music tastes until about 3 years ago were much, much narrower than they were. But then, and I was like, well, I don't feel like there's any good music. And then I realised that I would hear people saying that about film and just be like, shut up. Because I watched a lot of films and I was like, no, there's lots of films that are great. And then I just thought, like, well, maybe if I listened to more music, I'd hear some. And then I sort of read a lot of music review sites and tried to listen to a lot more stuff and got Spotify and whatever. And I now have a different opinion. But I had to take time and listen to a lot of stuff that I didn't like to figure out what I did like. And now I think there's good stuff. Another example, which is very relevant to the guys in Europe, which I haven't said before, was when I visited you just about a year ago last year. Prior to that point, I thought that YouTube was not worth my attention. I was just like, this is not like... I had a vague idea that online was the future, mainly because I was bitter that no film festivals were accepting my films, and therefore they must be the ones that are wrong. And I must be loved somewhere. But apart from that, that was all I had. And then you guys showed me a lot of very good YouTubers, you know, like H1MacGy, Lindsay Ellis, ContraPoints, and then I was like, oh no, this medium is not only very important, relevant, like, it is now, in my opinion, like, the, you know, I would now say that ContraPoints is probably one of the three most important filmmakers on Earth, and I would not say that lightly. I've given that statement a lot of thought.
But then you just have to look at H-Bomber Guy's recent charity stream to show that, oh yeah, this is not just a niche thing on the internet that only nerds know about and doesn't really affect the real world. It's like, no, this has a lot of clout.
Let's see if this statement comes back to bite me. I would say that one day we will look at YouTube to film the way that people look at the electric guitar to music.
Yeah.
I think that it is a radically different form aesthetically that, like, old people just can't, well, not even old people, lots of young people who have certain tastes just can't fucking hack.
Yeah.
And act, but actually it's going to change things a lot. I was obnoxious and had to have people show it to me to think that it was good. And also, like, I then had to go and do some work myself and watch it. And the thing is, like, watching new things is hard, whatever age you are. Like, it's scary and it's difficult. And you do a bit more when you're younger because everything's new. And then the older you get, the harder it gets. But if you want to find good new stuff, you just have to do it.
And as I was saying, coming back to the thing about video games, they're perhaps the most intimidating because even the easiest games have a basic entry level of, can you move point X into, like, you look at something like The Witness, can you solve these puzzles in order to progress? Can you beat this boss? Can you jump over this thing? Can you walk this thing over here? Which is intimidating to people who've never encountered it. But there's lots of good stuff there. Jim, right. You've got a few seconds to make your final points.
Yeah. You guys.
Great.
There we go.
There it is. He agrees with us, Callum. We win the discourse.
So, yeah, state of video games. Interesting. There's untapped potential. I think, yeah, it is worth saying that I do think it's true that there isn't as much innovation as there should be. However, I think it is more important to say that there is untapped potential because That is more true, because innovation is happening if you look for it. It's not hopeless.
Yes. I don't think it's hopeless. I mean, a lot of the things I've heard a lot of people talk about is that there are people in the industry in significant positions who recognize we need to take steps to really push what we can do with this.
Well, it's like what Callum says earlier. It's like, it's not really that different to what's already happened to film. Yeah. Like, these things just come and go in waves. It's gonna, like, it's gonna come around again, guys.
They'll follow the money until we take means of production.
Yeah. Revolution. Marx.
Navarra.
Just a little shout out to Navarra Media. Just like,
yeah, the best.
You should probably start recording, Jim.
Yeah, I was just giving me a few options there of where to cut. What a Waste of Time featured the voices of me, Jim Woodall, Nick Hurd, and Callum Smith. Music by Anthony Bullinger.